From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how the COVID catastrophe in Texas is challenging everything having to do with Texas politics. And Tesla is coming to Texas, but what does that mean? Will it drive the state towards green, sustainable transportation and energy solutions? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Texas is losing in the fight against COVID-19. The refusal of Republican state leaders to mandate face masks and put in place a serious lockdown has given the coronavirus a clear path to burn through the state's population. COVID-19 is infecting communities, filling up hospitals, and leaving so many dead that the bodies are being stored in refrigerator trucks. Meanwhile, the state is trying to get the schools to reopen, which public health officials agree would only make this situation much worse. It's impossible to have a disaster of this magnitude and not have people in power who have ignored the warning signs pay a political penalty, but what will that look like? I asked Harvey Kronberg, founder of the Quorum Report, how has the pandemic changed politics in Texas?
The basic mechanics of running a political campaign, for instance, are pretty much shot down. You can't have candidate gatherings. You can't do block walking. You can't have any personal interaction. So it moves everything to social media and to television and electronic media. Second, I think people have noticed that the economy has plummeted and that we face a fairly dire legislative session coming up, and we have no idea actually how we're going to be able to conduct the next legislative session. They've got plexiglass barriers between desk mates in the Texas House of Representatives. Third, I think the governor, who had an enormous amount of political capital just 4 months ago, has seen that erode, and Dan Patrick, the lieutenant governor, who was seen as a possible challenger once upon a time, is beginning to act, and then swore that he wouldn't be a challenger, is beginning to once again act like a challenger. And then finally, the far right, I think, very loyal to President Trump. The numbers are clearly diminishing, and what had once been rock-solid coalitions, for instance, elderly folks, which I include myself in, were rock-solid supporters of the president, and the erosion, I am told by private pollsters, is measurable. Republicans are in trouble with women, with minorities, with millennials, and now with older folks, which were part of the savings account that saved them last time. We're actually behind the curve on a couple of other levels, too. Normally, you would especially when you see a budget crisis coming, and we do have a budget crisis coming. It's much more than what Comptroller Hager talked about the other day. Appropriate committees would be meeting. The negotiations would be ongoing. There would be a lot of activity around the Capitol, especially starting next month, August, to start getting ready. We have a speaker who is not going to be returning, and it's not even clear which party is going to run the House. If we don't have a vaccine by Election Day, I think Democratic odds are pretty high, although turnout is still a very big issue. As a result of all that, the mechanical functions of government have somewhat ground to a standstill. The Capitol complex is essentially abandoned. People are working from home. I say this only half humorously, but Austin is a hospitality center. That's part of a political world. And that's where many deals get done, is over drinks or dinner or whatever. It's easy to kind of laugh at that as part of the mechanics of politics, but in all truth it is. And there's now jeopardy simply to meet and have a drink and try and iron out some kind of a legitimate problem. So everything that was is now in question in terms of how you operate a government, and there is no leading authority. There's nobody with an enormous amount of political capital. Fear for your health and fear for the health of your loved ones is not a good political dynamic if there's no solution at the end of the road.
How much responsibility should Governor Greg Abbott bear for where are we right now with this pandemic?
He took his cues from the president, and I think that in retrospect, taking your cues from the president wasn't a failed strategy in Texas up until the pandemic began. But in this case, it proved to be disastrous.
He went against local county judges and mayors, mm-hmm. and told them that they could not enforce mask wearing ordinances. And he also worked against the shutting down of businesses. We had the North Texas hair salon woman that he and other Republican leaders embraced, which contradicted the orders to lock down.
Essentially, he was trying to claim any good news and push bad and hard and painful decisions downstream. But the only one that anybody ever saw on television as a centerpiece was the governor. And if you remember, when he was doing the daily briefings or even the weekly briefings, they weren't really instructions on how to keep your family safe and healthy. They were inventories of ventilators and hospital beds. And then muzzling and essentially binding the hands of local governments who saw what was happening far more clearly, apparently, than the governor did, I think added to the disaster. But at the end of the day, it was the president who set the tone, and not all Republican governors followed the president's tone, which was defiant, which was trivializing the nature of the disease. And it wasn't until we hit critical mass, 10,000 cases, no hospital beds left in the valley, and the Houston Medical Center overwhelmed, which is the largest medical center in the country, to began to have an impact. And really, the bottom line is that at the very beginning of all of this, most people didn't know anybody that had been impacted by it. Now everybody knows somebody that has been impacted by it, either friend, family, coworker. In my shop, we had one, fortunately, young person that came down with COVID and essentially put us into a quarantine for a couple of weeks. Fortunately, nobody else caught it. But that kind of ripple effect throughout the economy, not just throughout the economy, but from throughout the social fabric. I don't know any political personality that could withstand that.
So we're seeing that Governor Greg Abbott is under 50% for his job approval rating. He's underwater, which is unusual for him and Republican governors in Texas. People are seeing polls as well that show that a Democrat presumptive presidential nominee Joe Biden has a 1 or 2 point lead over incumbent Donald Trump. What does that tell us?
Those are all symptomatic of it. It's one other thing I should mention. Instead of putting together a blue ribbon panel of physicians and epidemiologists, he put together a blue ribbon panel of contributors and treated it as a political operation rather than as a public health operation. So they were weighing the pros and cons in terms of politics before they realized that the narrative had overwhelmed them, had just swept over them. Mark McClellan, the former head of Medicare and Medicaid, was on that panel and has distanced himself from it because it's more of a political operation. He perceives it as more of a political operation than a public health operation. The once rock-solid Republican bedrock has certainly shifted. We saw that begin in 2018. We have 65% of our votes come from 16 counties in Texas. Just by definition, those counties, because of density, they're going to have a higher rate of infection, and it's just impossible not to see the tragedy around you all the time. Science has a solution, not politics. I mean, there's no political catchphrase that can turn this around. On top of that, we've got a hurricane season coming, and county leaders are, particularly on the Gulf Coast, I won't say frantic, but the distribution system on getting masks, ventilators, and PPE to physicians over the course of a couple of months was a disaster. I mean, they can only imagine what when you've got an epidemic raging through your state and then a natural disaster, how that all adds up. We have no resources left to commit to a natural disaster at this stage. So, and a president who is only yesterday began to talk seriously about the nature of the pandemic and what it was doing to the country and steps that were being taken.
Still, you have to wonder if the rock-solid Republican voter in Texas is going to assume that had a Democrat been in office, that things would have been better. And that this
I'm not sure that's how they're going to phrase the question. I mean, yeah, we've talked a lot over the years, and I've always said that incumbents don't get beat, they get fired. Up until Beto O'Rourke injected some enthusiasm into the party, it was fairly moribund. And so they got to play on the edges. They were never really major contributors to public policy. It was a Republican-dominated state for, you know, obviously for 20-some-odd years. And so who would look to a Democrat to be a voice in the wilderness? Ironically, I don't even think they're part of the equation. I think, for instance, former Vice President Biden did himself more good by mostly staying out of sight for the last 6 weeks than he would have done had he been doing some kind of active campaigning. The president was digging himself into a deeper and deeper hole.
There's still a lot of time between now and November 3rd.
That's right.
People point out the Michael Dukakis and George H.W. Bush, and
right,
that
right.
Dukakis in July was up by double digits, and it looked like the election was his to lose. And
absolutely.
Then there was an aggressive campaign by Lee Atwater, putting out the Willie Horton ad, and was able to get Bush his victory.
And Dukakis, of course, made the fatal mistake of getting into a tank with a helmet. But which
sure, he had a bad debate performance, and
yes, so any number of possibilities, and it's entirely possible that the Trump camp is trying to sell the storyline that Vice President Biden is too old, he's mentally infirm, and it's entirely possible that the event could cause a 180 in the way the polls are moving right now. There's also the possibility of external military threats, which do bring the country back together under its leader.
Depending on how the leader deals with that threat.
Exactly.
But you mentioned turnout, and we're just coming out of the runoff elections, and we saw a record turnout for the Democrats.
I went by a number of early polling places, and, of course, people were separated by 6 feet. What struck me, of course, is July in Texas, which means it's 90 to 100 degrees everywhere, and yet everyone was wearing masks and half the people were wearing gloves. They were not going to be deterred in this vote. Now that they've taken mail-in ballots for most people off the table, early voting, I think, is going to be even more important this time because folks are not going to want to wait for 4 or 5 hours. The mechanics of the election, of election day, are going to be, it's going to be a long night any way you look at it.
Well, it'll be a historic night.
Yep. And you raised the question, can Vice President Biden beat President Trump? None of Trump's previous formulas are working with the backdrop of the pandemic. But we shouldn't forget the fact that demographically Texas has changed pretty dramatically, and that we had entire Republican suburban counties get swept by Democrats in the last election. And that was before we had something that was life-threatening on the table. So I'm certainly not putting any money on the table that Vice President Biden will win Texas, but I think that the odds have gone up by some order of magnitude that Democrats are going to take the House and at least have a shot at being within 1 or 2 points of the presidency.
Harvey Kronberg is the founding editor of The Quorum Report, an online newsletter dedicated to covering Texas politics. This is Texas Matters on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This week, billionaire Elon Musk, the CEO of Tesla Motors, announced that they would be building their Cybertruck Gigafactory in Austin. This sounds great, but what is a Gigafactory and what is a Cybertruck? But more importantly, the question should be, what is the future of transportation? Many authorities in the auto industry predict that the next time that you buy a brand new car, it will likely be electric. To find out more, I reached out to Zach Caldaldo. He's the co-host of the YouTube channel Now You Know, which produces Tesla Time News. I asked him, why did Elon Musk pick Austin?
I think there's a couple big reasons. One is that Texas is a huge car market, right? So 25% of new vehicle sales in Texas are pickup trucks. And as we know, Tesla is coming out with the Cybertruck. And I think it's really important for Tesla to have this be an American-made truck and to really make a statement about it. And so having it built in Texas, I think, is kind of that statement. The second part is that Texas right now, you can't buy a Tesla in Texas because of the dealership laws. And so I think this is going to change that. I think that once Tesla has a factory in Texas, it's going to send the message to lawmakers that they're going to have to change their policy. And so I think this is going to open up that car market for Tesla even more.
Explain that a little bit more. I've seen Teslas on the roads here. I mean, they had to buy them somehow. How do they buy those Teslas?
Yeah, so when you want to buy a Tesla now, it's different than almost any other car company. You actually just go online and you choose, you know, the options you want. You click a few things and then you buy it online and then you pick it up at a service location. But in Texas and a couple other states, the dealership laws have prevented Tesla from selling direct to customers. So you have to pick up your Tesla in a neighboring state.
The dealerships, they have a lot of political sway and they have been able to block Tesla and other innovations in car selling. Probably this is not good for consumers, I imagine.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem kind of anti-American in a way. It's not a great deal for the car buying public. It does seem smart to go to the way we buy a lot of things now, which is to just purchase them online. But, you know, you're right. Dealerships are very powerful. They have a big lobbying effort. And so they kind of knew that the writing was on the wall, that they need to stop Tesla for as long as possible. It's just that I think that day has come. It's not going to last much longer. Most states have already found that those dealership laws are either unconstitutional or they've just changed those laws in the legislature.
So back to why you think Elon Musk picked Texas. Were there any other factors? I mean, Austin, what did it have that maybe attracted Elon?
Tesla's going to need, in the last earnings call that came out yesterday, Elon said, if there's one takeaway from this earnings call that I hope everyone remembers, is that we are looking to hire people. And so in each new market that Tesla goes into, the one thing that they're kind of, that we don't have enough of is great people, smart people. Our educational system really hasn't kept up with the kind of engineering that we need to run these big technological companies. And Tesla is one of them. They need tons of engineers. So when they open a new gigafactory, you might just think, oh, well, that's just a factory. You just need some line workers. But actually, it's more about engineering is what they need. They need, you know, process engineers, mechanical engineers, civil, materials, electrical, software, computer hardware. So when they go to a new place, they're looking, is there enough talent to where we're going? And I believe that you know, Elon knows the Austin area really well. It's a big tech hub in this country. And so I think he knows that that's a great space to move into because there's going to be great talent to pull from.
How do you think the arrival of a gigafactory, and explain what a gigafactory is, how do you think this is going to change the economics of the region?
Yeah, so a gigafactory is kind of unlike, the scale is so big, it's hard to imagine. The gigafactory in Nevada, you know, most people need bicycles to get from one end to the other. These are, Elon's idea is to build gigawatt hours of batteries at these plants along with the vehicles. He wants to vertically integrate. So he wants a factory where basically you bring raw materials into one end of the factory and then, you know, cars or whatever you're making come out the other end. So they're giant in scale. And so when they move into an area, we're talking about hiring thousands of people. So in Fremont, California, where they've got their main factory that's making the Model S, the Model X, and the Model 3, and the Model Y, they have about 10,000 employees there. And so at Giga Nevada, they've got 7,000. Giga Shanghai, which just opened, they've got 2,000. So it from the papers that I've seen, the initial applications, it looks like Giga Austin would have about 5,000 employees in the first 2 or 3 years. And so that's a lot. That's a big workforce.
The Cybertruck, this is an unusual looking truck. Many people in Texas is a truck state. They drive their F-150s or their Dodge Rams, and they know what to expect is what a truck will look like. But the Cybertruck shatters many of those expectations. The question is whether or not the truck buying market will take to that.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I was at the Cybertruck unveiling, and I got a chance to actually ride in the truck. And when the truck drove up onto stage, I was live streaming, and I almost dropped my phone because I was like, I was prepared for something crazy. I mean, Elon had hinted at this. With all sorts of, you know, things to do with, you know, movies and stuff. But when it rolled up on stage, I just was like, what? This is the truck? And I remember on my live stream feed, there were all these people saying the exact same thing. Like, that is ugly. I'm never going to buy one. And then a miraculous thing seemed to happen about half an hour later where the tone totally changed, where people started going, you know what? I kind of like it. And I got to be honest, the same thing happened to me. As soon as I saw it a little bit more, It was so weird when it came out. It was so different than anything I've seen. But the specs kind of speak for themselves. I mean, a truck that you can smash a sledgehammer into and that you don't dent, that speaks to, I think, a lot of pickup truck owners, where you want something that's built tough. So the features of this truck are going to pretty much blow away anything that Ford or Chevy have, which I think is going to be, even if you don't like the look of it, I think is going to speak to a lot of people.
Yeah,
and to get to numbers, there's over 600,000 people who put down money, who put down a deposit to get the truck already. So that does tell you that there's quite a bit of demand for it.
Sure, it's a refundable $100 deposit. And it will have to be able to stand up to punishment like sledgehammers, because there are people who will just absolutely continue to hate what the Cybertruck looks like and see it as a challenge to their identity. And we've seen other Teslas attacked on the roads because there is some sort of warped sense of that this is too much for me to process.
Yeah, it's a really human phenomenon, and it happens all throughout history. It's nothing new. When there's a change, our first reaction, because we are tribal creatures, is to think that's weird. I'm going to reject that. But given time, most of us come around. I mean, I remember when people around me were like, I'm never going to use a smartphone, and now they're using them.
In addition to the Cybertruck, there is the Semi. This is a battery-powered electric Semi, and that's something else that people have to wrap their heads around. It also looks different, and this is something that Elon has been talking about for quite a while, and now he says this is something that they're all in on, and they're ready to move at as quickly as they can.
Yes, I mean, that's a very sleek-looking truck. It's going to be made also at the Austin Gigafactory, which is exciting. We're on the list here on the Now You Know YouTube channel. We're high up on the list to get the semi-truck, and our plan is to drive it all around the U.S. and Europe to get truck drivers in it. Our big belief is that, to your point about people not liking change, there's one thing to see something. There's another thing to experience it. And so we believe in butts and seats. We believe that once you drive a Tesla and you feel what it's like and you get the full experience, that you're going to probably change your mind. That's what we've encountered so far. So our idea is, we want to get truck drivers in this truck to experience it. Some of the big things are, I don't think truck drivers really care too much about the looks or what's driving the truck if it saves them money and if it's reliable. And so the numbers for the truck, the specs, are what I think are going to speak to most people. And that's why I think so many companies like Walmart, Budweiser, and so forth have put down money to get the truck, because if the numbers work out to be right, they're going to save a lot of money on their fleets.
What about the reductions of climate change emissions?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big one for us on this channel. We're really into sustainable energy and transportation. But I think for the average American, if it doesn't work on all the other levels first, then it doesn't really matter to them whether this car is clean or not. Personally, I think we should be putting a bigger price on carbon and a bigger price on air pollution. It's one of those externalities that we can't really see or put our fingers on, and so we tend not to count it. But it's actually super duper important to our health, to our environment. But I think even if you took that off the table, most people are going to get into EVs, into electric cars and trucks, because of the money savings, because they are safer, because they have so many advantages, lack of maintenance, and so forth.
And a lot of people say they're fun to drive.
They are fun to drive. This semi-truck, for example, will be like driving a Porsche. So when you're getting a big semi-truck that's fully loaded onto a highway, to get that truck from the on-ramp up to highway speeds, you've seen it, we've all experienced it, especially if you're behind one, it takes a long time. This truck will have a 0 to 60 acceleration unloaded, fast, that'll beat most Porsches, and fully loaded it'll drive incredible. It'll drive so the acceleration will be so incredible, and that I think is something that many truck drivers are going to be so excited about, being able to actually drive the truck in a way that's safer.
This location that Elon picked out, east of Austin in the Del Valle area, it has the Highway 130 going right near there, which is a toll road, has an 85 mile an hour speed limit, which is frequently ignored, whereas people will drive generally in an excess of 100 miles an hour on that thing. It seems like that's a great place to try out a semi truck that drives like a Porsche.
That could be.
But it does have a problem with hogs on the highway. And I don't mean motorcycles. I mean wild hogs. Talking more about greenhouse gases and how Elon Musk has stated that one of his goals is to create market-driven solutions towards sustainable energy and a reduction of greenhouse gases and trying to help save the planet from this catastrophic climate change. He's not just known for Tesla. He's also known for other battery and solar and green energy innovations. Mass battery storage is something that he has been working on. Will all these things come along simultaneously?
Yeah, it's hard to picture, right? Because I feel like when I was a kid, I believed a lot of things were going to happen right away, and they never seemed to. And so I think we've fallen into this feeling of like, well, we haven't been to the moon in a while, and nothing really exciting has happened. So I guess it's just going to be like this. But I think that a whole bunch of technologies are converging together at the same time now. And we're about to hit a very fast, in my eyes, it's happening right now, but the general public is going to start to feel like we're hitting a very fast technological era where all these things are coming together. So you've got solar prices, which are coming way, way down. Wind prices, as you know, in Texas, coming way, way down. The problem being, though, with solar and wind is that when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing, what do you do? Well, battery prices are coming down. And so as Tesla has shown in a bunch of places around the world, like in Hornsdale in South Australia, you can build a giant battery, what Tesla is calling the Megapack, and you can store megawatt hours of energy for the short amount of times that you need them for when the sun isn't shining or the wind isn't blowing. And you can stabilize the grid. And we can also put solar on our roofs. It's just that for the longest time, there hasn't been much incentive to do that. But now that energy prices are going up, if people want to put, say, solar on the roofs and a Tesla Powerwall in their house, they can actually become their own little mini utility. And we're beginning to see that just grow in leaps and bounds. And so I believe that our new utility is going to be more of these microgrids where solar on our roofs, batteries in our garages are going to actually power the grid.
Do you think the arrival of Tesla in Texas will have an impact on beyond just all the things we've talked about? I mean, like psychologically in Texas.
Yeah, I do. I mean, if I'm in a little bubble here in my YouTube world of talking about Tesla all the time. I feel like everyone knows about it. But when I meet people around the country, one of the things my son and I did first with our Tesla Model X is we drove from Boston to San Francisco and back and, through 25 states. And we would purposely stop and, throw the doors up. Those are those Falcon Wing doors. And people were just like, what is that, a spaceship? And I think today, well, it's 4 years later, everyone must know about it. But actually, recent surveys have shown that only 30% of people in America have actually sat in or driven an EV at all. That's not just Teslas, that's any EV. So we're still in this little bubble. Many people maybe have heard the word Tesla or know that it's some kind of car company. Many people I talk to think it's an Italian company or it's a European company. They don't know that it's an American company. So I think by moving to Texas, it's going to get more press. It's going to get, more word out about it. And I think that more and more people are going to realize this is an American company making cars. And it's been over 100 years since we've had a new American company making cars.
Zach Cataldo is the co-host of the YouTube channel Now You Know, which covers all things Tesla and Elon Musk. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where you can find past episodes of Texas Matters, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.